Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm delighted to be sitting across from Caroline Ovington, who's coming to talk about The Ones You Trust, her latest thriller, which I read in two sittings. Welcome, Caroline.
Hello.
This is one hell of a book.
Thank you.
I'm going to say that straight up because I have to read a lot of books for these podcasts and interviews and the like, and it makes it so much easier if I cannot put the damn thing down.
Exactly. Well, that's the idea. The idea is that you're meant to get on this train and then you're like, it's like a bullet train. You're just off and you can't get off it. That's it.
I want to sort of talk about the setup because it's sort of beginning, but we can't really go into too much detail. It's one of those ones which you really just got to let you do the magic on us.
Well, look, the idea came to me. So I thought to myself, the premise of the book is you have a really busy mum who turns up at the daycare centre to pick up her daughter and she's not there. And I thought that's just the jumping off point for so many different scenarios. So if you think it through, did something happen at the daycare centre and are they now covering up and saying, oh, she was never here? Or did somebody else pick her up from the daycare centre? If so, who and why and where is she now? Or did something happen at home and the parents are saying they did take her to the daycare centre? There were so many possibilities. And I thought, and also once the police become involved in a case like that, you would have questions about who is her husband? How loyal and devoted is he? Who is the nanny? What's her background? Who else in the mum's life might have reason to wish harm upon her? They're obviously a wealthy family. Is this for money? So it seemed like there were so many possibilities. And the idea in the book is to try to keep all those balls in the air at the same time so the reader is never sure which way to jump.
Because you hit the reader in the guts in the first page. Like you've got a little child, a very little child, like a toddler, just walking and by themselves in a mall and you've got a security guard coming over and asking, and it's one of those great fears of,
yes,
of any parent, especially someone that young, that vulnerable, to be alone if
yes.
you ever see it.
Yes.
At all.
And that's true because, I mean, I am very conscious of the fact that nobody wants to read a book in which something horrible happens to a child. That is always in the back of my mind. It's got to be a thriller on different levels. Mm-hmm. You've got to be concerned about the adults and you've got to be caught up in that, but you have to be careful not to give the idea that something is bad is going to happen to a child. So I was conscious of a time when I lost one of my own kids in the street. I wanted to get that feeling across. So I had twins, as you know, and we live in Bondi and there was no parking at my house. So I had this situation where you'd have to drive around your house or around your streets trying to find a car park with the two little infants in the back. And then you'd either have to try to get them both out of their baby seats at the same time and then sort of put one on the hip and then go around the other side and somehow get the other one out and put it on your hip and then come up your concrete steps and through somehow try to get through the front door. So what I would usually do would I'd leave one in the car, run upstairs, put the other one inside, run back downstairs for the other one and then come back in. So I did that one day and I left Chloe in the car. I ran upstairs with Michael, put him inside, ran downstairs to get Chloe. And by the time I got back, Michael was gone. So he'd worked out, you know how when they're little and they work out how to come backwards down the stairs with their little nappies going down? So he'd worked out how to come back down the stairs and he was lost in the street. And I just remember that feeling, John. I just, that wild fear that it's everything they say is true. Your heart just races and your blood runs cold and you feel a sense of dislocation, like you're going mad. And I wanted to catch that feeling in the adults as well, because that is how it feels. And he was fine. It turned out that he'd managed to get next door under the stairs where they kept their tools and, you know, little boys and tools. So he had got hold of the screwdrivers and he was making little holes in the dirt. But also that feeling when I held him, oh, you know, just squeezing the life out of him. I think those are experiences that all parents will immediately understand.
And you make great use of that.
Yeah. That, well, the parents, should be the ones who are panicking, right? They should be, because I think people have said to me in the past, oh, I don't want to read a book about, you know, something horrible happening to a child. And I don't either.
Mm. The you know, you've got other things going on, because you've got the parents' anxieties, then you've got people's jobs who are then involved in finding what's happened, and they've got problems and requirements of their own, and they've got anxieties and concerns and things going on. I just love the way you pile it on. Like, you've got,
I'm so glad.
Because
so
you've got the initial anxiety and just keep piling it on. I mean, I'm a reformed nail biter, but it was not during this. Just reading, yeah, it was just terrible. I was just, wow.
I'm so pleased to hear that.
And I had to stop because of a thing called sleep.
All right,
it got in the way, and then I just knocked it off. And the following morning, I just went bang straight through the
whole thing. I'm so glad, because that to me is always a sign that you've written a book that's got some pace. If people can just keep, you know, rocketing through it.
You got pace. It's more like falling out of a plane without a parachute. There's pace going on there.
Well, that's good. Yeah, you want some pace to it, because people do read pretty quickly these days. Yeah. And you know what else I've noticed, and you've probably noticed this too, how much people are reading these days.
Yeah.
Like, they're reading one book after another, and so much of it is Australian fiction. Like, those they are loving Australian fiction. Those old days where if you wanted to be taken seriously as a writer, by which I mean make an income from being a writer, you know, you had to go overseas. You had to be Clive James or Germaine Greer, and off you went. Whereas now there are dozens of Australian writers making a living right here. And they're not writing stories for the foreign market. No. They're writing stories about Brisbane and Sydney and Melbourne. It's so
and
great.
And the bush.
The bush, yeah, that's right. The bush is coming back.
Well, I remember in my shop many years ago, people would pick up a book and see a review by an Australian newspaper on the front and then put it back down.
Right.
Because obviously an Australian newspaper talking about a book means the book must be an Australian book.
Right. And there was this feeling that you wanted to be reading international authors. They were the rock stars, weren't they?
We had the Grishams, the Cornwell, and all these big stars coming in. Now they're sort of shoved to the side as we've got our own massive stars.
And I heard actually in Adelaide at the Writers' Festival for the first time this year, the local writers like Helen Garner and some of the others were outselling the big international names for the first time, which is great, because it used to be you'd have a big international writer come into the festival and all of the Australians would sort of lean on them.
Yeah.
So you'd have someone selling, you know, like say David Sedaris would sell 2,000 tickets to his event.
Yeah.
And then you could then use the money you've made to host a few Australian writers in smaller tents on the side. But that's not the case anymore. People want to read Australian stories.
We've got someone like Leanne Moriarty.
Incredible. She's conquered the world.
Yeah,
she has.
I want to return to your book because that's why we're here. I want to talk about your relationship with morning TV people.
I don't know how long I'm going to have one for.
So for those who don't know, this book does have a mother involved, and there is concern about a child. But what does the mother do?
So she is the host of a morning TV show, which is called Kappa, and she has a co-host. So she's the mum of three who isn't, she's not meant to be sexy. She's meant to be, I guess, what they call mumsy in TV land.
Yep.
So she's kind of like a, not a blonde, more of a sort of brunette, and she's a bit, she's a little bit overweight, but not too overweight. So she's like that classic mum character that they have on morning TV shows. And then he's the bad boy. So he's the one who rocks in late because he's been out drinking and he's, you know, his suit is a bit askew, that kind of thing. And in some pages of the book, she notes how different the world is for her. Like, she thinks to herself, she's furious one day because he's late. He's late skidding into the studio. And she's like, I could never turn up drunk. I could never turn up just putting my heels on, you know, tripping over the cords on the floor, sitting there talking about how I've got a terrible hangover. You know, I always have to be perfectly turned out. I always have to be the one who laughs at his sort of boyish humor. She feels the pressure, and she also has that pressure of she's aging. So she's getting well into her 40s. She's got sort of the first lines are appearing on her face. She goes to the beach one weekend and she has her bathers on and she's got her daughter with her and there's paparazzi in the bushes and they take photographs of her. And then the next day on one of the scandal websites, they've sort of zoomed in on her thighs and drawn big circles around the porridge on there and talking about, you know, whether she's stacked on the weight with the third pregnancy. It's terrible, but it's very real.
Oh, this is the thing. So we've been talking about the thrills and the suspense and the way it drives through, but you are like on the bullseye and so many times in this book of social commentary about where we are right now.
Yeah.
And the media world, but also male-female relations, gender equality, this whole range of these things just bang, bang. And this is what I love about this book is you get so much of this in and it still moves. Like it still flies along and you just get bang, bang. And the stuff around morning TV and the comments and the analysis of that in these wonderfully wicked lines.
Well, can you, I imagine what it would be like to live when you're in the public eye like that. And of course, that's why the disappearance of the little girl is such a massive news story. Because when I was looking and researching the book, I thought to myself, I mean, let's say one of the scenarios is, could you get a child out of the childcare centre? That's what police are thinking about. Mm-hmm. Could you actually get a child out of a childcare centre if you're a stranger? And I did some research and I looked around at the number of times that has actually happened in real life. Either a child has been left behind in a childcare centre after they're locked up for the day or disappeared from a childcare centre. It's not at all unusual. And it doesn't always make massive news. This makes massive news because of who she is,
yeah.
Because she's already a big star. And so this is 24-hour coverage. I mean, you can imagine what that would be like. It would be ticker tapes all day long if it was someone really famous and their daughter had gone missing. And all the questions that would be asked about what kind of mother she is. Mm. And, you know, she's got lots of balls in the air, she's working, she's got kids, but and she would be responsible for sure. They wouldn't be looking at the husband or the nanny. It would be her fault.
Yeah. Did you go when you went, she's on TV? Did you go, Eureka?
No, I wanted her to have a job that was really busy but not boring.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want a job where I thought to myself, oh, she just goes to the office all day.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be a job that had a bit of glamour associated with it. And I also wanted to say some things about the pressures on women and how women in particular feel the pressure to be a great mum and also very present at work.
Well, in the beginning, can you just describe her day? Because
Her day is chaos. I mean, the alarm goes off at 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm. She has three children still sleeping when she leaves the house. She has to get across town to the studio by 4 a.m. She's into hair. She's into makeup. She's into briefings. Then she's on air for 5 hours. She, like you, has to do all of the reading of the books of the authors who are coming in, or if they've got a movie star coming in, all the questions that have to be answered. She has to be dressed and undressed 5 times a day for her various events that she has to go to. And then when the show is over, after PJ, her sidekick, has kind of skidded in, done the TV, and they're not worried about it, she then has promotional activities. She has to go to lunches with sponsors. She has to various fundraising events. It's non-stop for her.
And because you've been in that world, how close to reality are you going? Is this your experience of some of these people who are?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And also I've done a bit of TV, morning TV myself. I've been a guest on morning TV, too many times to count. And I always feel that immense pressure. Do you know, sometimes you go on morning TV and you have your little conversation piece and you talk, and then when you come off and all your social media is, oh, I could see your bra strap, or I like your top, or more likely, I don't like your top. It's never, nobody seems to hear what you say. It's all about how you look.
Oh, I mean, it's just random. I mean, there've been so many different occasions in the last 10 years with both, you know, Sunrise and Today Show in their battle for supremacy of that morning bit, and both of the main women on both those shows just getting ripped to pieces.
I mean, completely destroyed. And that idea that you can't wear the same thing twice. So do you remember when Carl Stefanovic did that famous experiment where he wore the same suit every day for a year? And nobody noticed. Whereas, if you're a woman on TV, you can never wear the same thing twice. The minute you do, it's up on social media saying, thrifty so-and-so recycling her outfit. You know, it's just the different standard has always been apparent to me.
In writing this book, because we get to chat to you, through many years now.
We've been talking for years, you and I.
In this book, because it feels so, speedy. Was it something that came really fast, or did you write tons and then bring it down? Like, how did you get this incredible speed going?
Well, I never know where it's going. So I had the idea, and then I didn't really know who was responsible or what was going to happen. I just let that happen.
How's that possible? It seems like when you finish it, you go, oh, she was on this right from the beginning, and how clever she did.
No, I think the idea is that you have to have no idea, because then you'll be surprised.
But so then that just amazes me, because then how does the brain get all of those things to line up and it makes sense? So when you get to this end,
there's a lot of going back to make sure that the things you said might have happened could actually have happened. You have to do a lot of that.
Because there's a large cast of characters when you think about it.
Oh, so many of people could be responsible.
Yeah, and then...
There's it's not just the people in her own life, but she also has, like, because she's famous.
Yeah, it could be.
So there's, like, she's had trouble with people out in the street. She's had trouble with people who want to be a super fan. She has rivals for her job. She has a family that is extensive, you know, that she's had... many nannies as well, yeah. Many different childcare cycling in and out. So there's so many different scenarios, and the key is just to not let... And, of course, there's always the idea is the child actually missing? Let's not forget that as a possibility too.
Yeah. So when you're introducing all these characters, and you manage to, just in a few tiny brushstrokes, seems like, draw these people out. So the policemen and women that come through the door, the makeup artists, all these different things, all these different people that come through. Do you have in your mind, okay, this person, like, how much of development behind the scenes that we don't see around these characters are there? Or do you just sort of inhabit these people for the moment that they enter your
story? I think just for the moment. I know that there are writers who have a backstory for every character, mm. you know, where they were born, who their parents are, you know, what their motivations are, what the next step in their career will be, that kind of thing. And I don't do that so much. But I do keep a very, very close eye on people I meet in my real life.
Because they're sharp. Like, they're sharp. It's definitely a real person. Bang, there for a second.
Sometimes I see someone and I just know they're going to be in a character in a book. I just know they are, because they're quirky or they're interesting or there's something about their physicality that appeals to me, and I just kind of file them away. I used to do it on a notepad,
yeah.
But now I do it on notes on my iPhone.
So what's your ideal scenario when someone's reading this? Is this someone who is taking on a trip, is on a plane? You know, where do you want people? Like, in your mind, have you got an ideal reader in your head?
I am absolutely thinking of the person who really wants a fast, thrilling read. That's the person I'm thinking of. And whether that can be lying around by the pool drinking daiquiris, yeah. Right? You don't have to be super fast person yourself. But that is because that's the kind of reader I am.
Yeah.
I love to get lost in a book. I love it. I love it. And I love to be thinking to myself, I don't want to go to sleep. I'll just one more chapter. I'm that person. Yeah. And so that's what I want for the reader too.
Do you look at your career as a whole and look at the development of your writing techniques? Like, are you seeing that there is a development, there's a path for you in that sort of, in your...
Yes, I think, well, you always hope you're getting better. You don't know whether you are or not.
To me, I've been reading you for a long time, and this is the book that, for me, that just brings all of the things that you do really well together in one little package.
Oh, that's so great. Because, well, you always do hope you're getting better, and you also hope that... the reader is coming to know what to expect, that if I pick this up, I'm really going to like it.
And so the things like Matilda's Missing of, what was that, 2011?
2011, yes, yeah, I think so.
That relied heavily on your relationship with the court reporting,
yes.
And being there and the rest of it. This is relying on another aspect of your life. Are you going to keep plumbing the
Right.
Do I have to be nervous? Is there going to be a killer bookseller?
Well, hang on a minute, because you have just written a book that is completely plundered from real life. So you're in no position to criticise me.
It's all fiction. I have no idea what's going on. No, because when we were last talking about last year, we were talking about hanging to the side of the pool.
Yes.
And And I got the feeling that you just let loose and you let love and you're swimming out to the deep and enjoying yourself. And
I am enjoying it so much. And doesn't that make a difference when you're really enjoying it? It doesn't feel like work to me, John. And sometimes people do say to me, oh my goodness, you're very prolific. This is 12 books now you've got out. But I just love it. I mean, I really do enjoy it. It's a real break from everything else that's going on in your life. It's a break from your day job as well. There isn't anything about it that I don't love at the moment. And that's a good place to be in, because if you talk to writers, mostly they'll admit that there are troughs, right, where they just can't seem, they're grinding through the days.
Yeah.
And that is not the space I'm in.
And how do you manage to, like, because, you know, most writers in Australia will have other work going on.
Yes, they have to, really.
So do you set aside 4 months or something of the year, the way you try and bring down the level of work, or you've got the same level of work the whole year through, plus I write a novel in this time as well?
I write on Fridays.
Okay, so really?
I have Fridays off work and I write on Fridays. And I do a solid day's work on it. I start in the morning, I break for lunch, and I finish in the afternoon.
How many Fridays does it require to write?
Well, I have a book a year, so that's about right.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. People talk about, you know, I haven't got time to write. And yet if you can write a book a year on a Friday.
On a Friday. And then I find you do need it. Did you find when you were writing as well, you need a fair slab of time? Like for me, 2 hours here and an hour there and 2 hours there. It's good. You can fiddle away.
Yeah.
But I quite like the idea of being lost. I like looking up from the computer and realizing I'm not actually a woman hosting a TV program whose child is missing from the daycare center, because you're so lost in the character, you've inhabited it in a way. And that you only get with a long stretch of time, I think more than 6 hours to really get into the groove.
I generally do that as well. I'll try and hopefully do the full stint.
A long day rather than, but then there are other people who write from say between 5 and 9 in the morning and then don't look at it again.
Yeah.
Well, I know my friend Matthew Riley, he tells me that he writes in the morning. So sort of gets up, has breakfast, writes between 8 and 12, then has lunch with his girlfriend and then plays golf. And I'm like, that's like a dream gig.
I remember years ago when he used to come into the shop, he'd say, oh, I'm allowed to come to the shop now because I blew up the city that I wanted to blow up. You know, I set myself a task. If I do that, then I get to go to the shop.
Exactly, yeah. So there is very different processes depending on the person.
It is extraordinary because I get to interview writers day in, day out here, and the approach is so different for every single one. But one of the things that you get asked as a writer is how you do it and how can I do it and all these sort of things. And there isn't any answer we can give.
No.
Except you can give an example. Like, yes, we're all very busy, but if you take, you know, a certain amount of time every week, you'll have a book.
And there's always that sense that just put something down, because I do meet a lot of writers or a lot of people who want to write who can't get started. Mm. And so they're looking at an empty screen and then they start something and they erase it and then they walk away and they come back. Well, that's not going to work in my opinion, because just stick it all down, even stream of consciousness stuff, because you can fix that.
Yeah.
But you can't fix nothing.
No. Every time you're staring at that blank page, it's just...
And that would feel yuck inside, wouldn't it? You'd start to feel nightmarish inside. I interviewed a writer yesterday who has a book coming out, and she has 2 small children. I'm an empty nester now. My children are... I mean, for people who have been reading me for a long time, especially only in New York, who remember my children as toddlers... It is my melancholy duty to inform you that one of them now is now bumming around in California with a surfboard on his arm, and the other one is at a dance festival in Portugal. So that's how it just goes like that. It just goes so fast. But she had small children, and she said to me she was writing at a 24-hour McDonald's. She doesn't actually eat McDonald's because she's celiac, so she couldn't actually indulge in the food. But because with small children around, that's a challenge for women too.
Yeah, that has been for me. Just listening to you getting the kids out of the car is enough for me.
Exactly. I mean, when I think about it, God, I've been frantic, haven't I? And what's weird about being an empty nester is they're gone. They're just gone. Like, I didn't have that sense of one of them being off and then the other one still finishing school and then maybe the first one coming back for a bit, and then they just both... finished school, finished their HSC, decided to take a gap year and left. And just bang, like that. But that's twins, right? And I've had the advantages of having twins too, sending them through school together, never walking through the school gate on their own, always having someone to hold their hand, never that situation where I don't have a friend in my class. So all the benefits of having twins, but then the double whammy of losing them both at once.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it's a double whammy for you. There are parents out there who are going, that sounds fantastic.
That sounds great.
That sounds great.
Bring it on. I know. Well, I have a friend who has triplets, so I mean, I'm in
that'd be that'd be very, like, right now the noise in your noise level in your house has gone from this much to
total silence.
Yeah.
It is the strangest
thing. And
triplets
will just be that extra.
And also, do you know what else is really interesting? Power bills. They're like, I look at them and they're like $78. I know, because I haven't got a son running the shower for 4 hours a day.
And because I write by candlelight.
It's just like the impact they have on your house, that the sublime impact that they have on your life ends instantly.
I don't want to end on that. So I'm going to start and say, you've got to get hold of Caroline's books, The Ones You Trust, because it is absolutely unputdownable. This is, in my mind, the best one she's ever written, and I think you should all be getting hold of it and gobbling it down and then telling everyone else to get a copy of it.
Oh,
well.
John, you're the best. Thank you so much for saying all that.
And you can get all of Caroline's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.